to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, grassroots solar-powered community radio here in sunny Fairfield. Yeah. Today is March 9th, 2012, if you're listening to our live broadcast. And if you're listening to our rebroadcast on Monday morning, then hope you had a great weekend. And I hear we're having a real spring next week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, that's what I hear. It's supposed to be spring.
Just so it isn't an Arab spring.
So this is this is Writers' Voices, and I'm your guest, or I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me
she's with discombobulated today.
Is my yes, well, it's spring.
Yeah, that's true.
Is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilburn. Hi, Mom.
I'm going to start out with a quote today. There is no such thing as bad weather. There is inappropriate clothing.
Yeah, well, we know that in Iowa, that's for sure. That's for sure. So later on, I want to mention that Caroline was featured in the Catholic Messenger this week with her writing group at St. Alphonsus Church in Mount Pleasant. And we're going to share that article perhaps next week.
Because we have
full house today.
Yeah.
You want to introduce our guest today?
Yes. I would love to. Michael Schumann is Director of Research for Cutting Edge Capital, Director of Research and Economic Development at the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, and a fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute. He holds an AB with distinction in economics and international relations from Stanford University and a JD from Stanford Law School. He has led community-based economic development efforts across the country and has authored or edited 7 previous books, including The Small Mart Revolution, How Local Businesses Are Beating the Global Competition in 2006, and Going Local, 1998. His articles have appeared in New York Times, Washington Post, The Nation, The Weekly Standard, Foreign Policy, Parade, The Chronicle of Philanthropy, and he lives in Silver Spring, Maryland, and today we're going to be talking about local dollars, local cents.
And the subtitle of this is How to Shift Your Money from Wall Street to Main Street and Achieve Real Prosperity. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Michael.
Nice to be with you.
Now, we also have another guest with us in the studio today who is one of our local dollar proponents in Fairfield and is actually mentioned at length in Michael's book. Bert, welcome to Writer's Voices also.
Hi, great to be here.
And you've been on KRUU many times.
A few times, yeah.
Usually talking about movies, right?
Movies or who knows, I've been on many programs here, so it's been a lot of fun.
Great. So, Michael, tell us a little bit about how you came to write Local Dollars, Local Cents.
Well, the short story is that I have been working on local economics for about 15 years now, and it sort of started with a bit of a theoretical book that was called Going Local, came out in 1998, and was impressed with the importance of locally owned business and community self-reliance as principles for local prosperity. And I would say that book attracted a lot of the anti-globalization Battle of Seattle crowd. And then I started to notice that the crowd was increasingly becoming small business people. And by around 2001, there was enough of a critical mass of small business people that was interested in all of this that something called the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, or BALLE, was formed. BALLE has since grown into 80 business alliances around the United States that represent about 22,000 local businesses. And so the next book that I wrote that came out in 2006, The Small Mart Revolution, was about how these businesses were becoming increasingly competitive and sort of talked about a bunch of strategies that communities were using to nurture local small business. But what I was really impressed by in the writing of that book, and I don't think I offered really a lot of solutions in Small Mart issue on how you capitalize local businesses. And in the years since, I think many of us, including Bert, have sort of focused on this as being the biggest challenge in getting communities to be more self-reliant, more resilient. How do we get capital into local businesses? And so local dollars, local cents is a sort of compendium of great innovations that have been done by about three dozen institutions around the United States trying to solve this problem, and also some ideas of what might be coming down the pike in the next few years.
So, Michael, how did you find all these different people that have these ideas that are being really tried out in small scale, and maybe with your book we'll get a little broader distribution? How did you go about finding them?
Well, there were really two strategies. So the first is that for these 15 years that I've been working on local economy stuff, I've been doing about, I don't know, 25 to 30 speaking events per year. Almost, you know, every other week I go travel to someplace and speak. And so I meet the people on the ground who are working on this stuff. I sometimes call my life a political campaign that never has an election. It's just nonstop.
Oh, that's kind of sounds frustrating.
Well, it has its frustrating pieces, but it's also kind of exciting because what I've seen is that the enthusiasm has grown, the diversity of the crowds has grown, the political diversity of people involved in this movement has grown. So all of that has been very satisfying. So really, with all of those contacts around the country, that filled the book with a lot of case studies. And then the other thing was, is I just asked people who I was interviewing, who else do you think is doing great work, and discovered a lot of interesting stuff that way as well.
That should work. How much do you think this growth of local economies gets a boost from the internet and the way that we're able to communicate now?
Well, I think it's huge. And to be sure, there are reasons why the internet is a burden for local small business. I mean, certainly when you're talking about retailers and the way that local bookstores have had to compete against Amazon, or the way that other local merchandise proprietors have had to compete against, say, eBay or others out there, it's a challenge. But I think that was sort of the first generation of internet companies. The second generation of internet companies has more been how smaller businesses have taken advantage of some of these innovations and put them at the service of what they're trying to do. And really, I mean, at one level, the internet is about spreading high-quality information. So, you know, my contention is that local businesses actually have terrific competitive advantages over their non-local competition, but they have tiny advertising budgets, so they can't really let people know about their goods and services very well. And the internet has given them a better ability to market their stuff. The other thing that the internet provides was sort of summarized a few years back by a writer in Wired magazine who talked about what he called the long tail, which is to say that, you know, if you have, say, a garage band in Fairfield that produces a kind of, you know, say it was doing a mesh of calypso and Brazilian music, something you would never hear of, and perhaps in Fairfield, Iowa, it would draw a crowd of three people to a nightclub.
Okay.
But if they are able to share their music worldwide, there may be 10,000 people around the world who are interested in that peculiar kind of niche of music. And so the internet has allowed all of us to find our audiences worldwide and yet stay in the places that we love. And that's the key thing, that many of us, I would say most of us, really love our communities, love the places we've called home. And if we can use our homes then to participate in a broader range of work and professional activities, that's a good thing, and the internet allows that to happen.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, I'm involved in quite a number of businesses, and having been having an accounting practice, a local accounting practice for, heck, we're going on 30 years, and so I have a lot of knowledge about local business, but. It's really true that there are a lot of businesses that could not have reached the size that they have and the reach that they have without the internet, including some of my businesses. You know, we couldn't do them from here. We couldn't have done them from here 20 years ago the way that we can now. So it's been a real boon for that. So, Michael, let's go back a little bit to the kind of the basic premise of your book, which is the need for local capital, and what are some of the main barriers to local businesses getting capital?
Well, okay, so this, let's begin with the most depressing part of the story, which is Americans right now have about $30 trillion. In long-term savings. That's what households and nonprofits have. And that's in stocks, bonds, mutual funds, pension funds, insurance funds, you know, mostly what we're saving for our retirement. That money is virtually 100% invested in Fortune 500 companies or government bonds. Now, what's weird about that is that about half of our economy, by jobs and by output, is local small business. So if we had efficient capital markets, roughly speaking, half of those long-term assets would be going into local small business, but none of it is. So we're systematically over-investing in these Fortune 500 companies that many of us distrust, and under-investing in the local businesses we know are essential for community prosperity and job creation. So at a minimum, we can say that we have a capital market failure. And as I've looked at this question, I mean, the conventional view is, oh, well, local businesses aren't competitive, local businesses aren't profitable, but the fact is that local businesses actually have steadily maintained their job share of the U.S. economy in the last 20 years. And if they were not competitive, that would never have occurred. And we also know that sole proprietorships, which most local businesses are or start out as, are three times as profitable as C corporations, which most publicly traded companies are, with partnerships falling in between. So the explanation is really much more basic, and that is that we have a system of securities laws that was enacted in the early Jurassic period, that is during the Great Depression, and these securities laws make it exceedingly expensive in terms of legal bills for the 99% of us who are unaccredited, that is not wealthy people, to put our money into the 99% of firms that are small. And as we speak today, there is a debate going on in the U.S. Senate about whether to approve a bill that was approved in the House on crowdfunding reform that would totally overhaul those laws and make it much easier for unaccredited people to put as much as, well, and the House bill says as much as $10,000 per person per year with no legal rigmarole. I suspect when it comes out of the Senate, that'll get whittled down to $1,000 or maybe even less. But we are at the heart of a debate right now on Capitol Hill that will determine the future of local investment.
So, Michael, do you feel that you've had an influence in getting that bill into into consideration?
Well, indirectly. I mean, there's a lot of us, including Bert, who have been involved in this debate for many years. But here's a kind of funny footnote on all of it, which is 2 years ago, I wrote a piece in a journal of the Federal Reserve suggesting, recommending that there be a $100 exemption per person, per company, per year in securities law. And it was really mostly a little tongue-in-cheek suggestion to say, come on, securities guys, show us that, try to make the argument that $100 is so risky that you would shut out people from even doing that form of participation in local business. And a colleague of mine, Jenny Kasson at Cutting Edge Capital, wrote this up as a petition to the Securities and Exchange Commission and got close to 1,000 people to support this in letters to the SEC. And last May, at a hearing on Capitol Hill conducted by then the chair of the Oversight Committee, Daryl Issa, Mary Shapiro of the Securities Exchange Commission, you know, talked about that they had impaneled a commission within the SEC to study this and other proposals. And Issa and his Tea Party colleagues rolled their eyes and said, you know, you put together a commission on these simple reform ideas. So, you know, the committee went ballistic. They put together a bunch of reform alternatives. There were a number of people out there who've been pushing for these things. And by last December, the House voted 407 to 17 with 10 abstentions to create this crowdfunding exception in securities law.
Wow. Now, as a business owner, I wouldn't be very interested in getting $100 from a zillion people to fund my business.
But 10,000 would interest you.
10,000 would interest me, possibly. It, you know, depends on which business we're talking about and what the total needs are. Because, you know, the more owners you have, the more obligations you have, in a sense, you know.
Well, that's absolutely true. And I think one of the tensions that I talk about in the book is, you know, what are the structural ways that small businesses can kind of protect their independence and still take on many more shareholders? You know, you could have multiple layers of shareholders. You know, you hold on to the common shares and maybe other people invest in preferred shares. A lot of Wall Street firms do that, and local
right.
businesses could do that. Or you could have a co-op structure, which really democratizes things, and everybody is putting in small amounts of money, and maybe that's what you prefer. So there's a lot of different directions you can go in.
Michael, I read the chapter on co-ops. I'm working with a company here in town who's formed as a co-op, and there appear to be this exception now where you can legally be a co-op but be taxed as a partnership. How does that work?
Well, yeah, so this is a kind of new and controversial development, but only available in some states.
Right,
and
which
many
Iowa.
In the co-op community are nervous about this. And it's kind of a thorny area of law, so I won't bore your listeners by
okay.
getting too deep in it. But I'll just say that historically, consumer co-ops allowed, they're made up of members who put in a certain amount of capital, and their return is based on the amount in which they use the co-op. And many states have allowed over the years, and Organic Valley is an example of a company that's used this, have created a preferred shareholder class of outside non-member investors who can put money in, and then they get a certain dividend paid on what they put into the company. But they they have no control over the company at all. And recently in some states, there have been these new kinds of co-op partnerships created that kind of bring in, you know, side by side, the co-op members who vote and the investors who vote, and it's a hybrid that we're not sure what the outcome is going to be. So the jury is out whether these things work yet.
Bert, do you have any experience with these hybrid co-ops?
Well, Iowa's actually one of the states that has provided for this structure. I think it's interesting. It grew out of the ethanol industry where you'd get the co-op of farmers together, but the cost of the ethanol plant was more expensive than they could afford. And what happened was they created a copy of a law, I think it was based in Colorado or Wyoming, but it provided for an investor class into the co-op up to 40%, which allowed additional capital into those co-ops. I think it's an interesting model simply from the standpoint of if you need to, say, build a local food economy and you've got a co-op structure and the farmers have a certain amount of capital, it allows you to bring in outside investors that can participate in the program. Mm-hmm. So I know the laws are different from state to state. There isn't a federal statute. It's really a local orientation on the co-op laws.
You're listening to Writer's Voice.
What Americans don't entirely appreciate is that co-op law is almost entirely a state creature. And states have not only one co-op statute, but often they have different kinds of statutes for different types of co-ops, like ag co-ops versus consumer co-ops. If you're in Minnesota, there are 7 co-op laws you have to interpret. So it's a wonderful crazy quilt. It's wonderful employment for attorneys who work on this stuff. But it also underscores that as a state, you can be really creative with your co-ops. And for example, we give the case study of a company called Co-op Power in Western Massachusetts, which, you know, takes from its members not $50 or $100, but $1,000, and has used that money to then turn around and support other energy efficiency companies, you know, in theory to provide lower cost products for energy efficiency and renewable energy production to its members. But it's effectively a co-op investment mechanism. And, you know, I think the state statutes could even go further along those lines to help create investment mechanisms that had a co-op structure.
Well, historically, co-ops have played a very important role in the development of America. We have the rural electric co-ops, without which many of our rural people would not have had electricity for many, many years. Was the Grange a co-op? Do you remember?
Well, yeah, it was. Grange is, you know, was interesting as it was formed probably in the Depression to give farmers a voice.
Yeah,
and it was very effective.
Yeah. So, and I know in your book, Michael has some other examples of co-ops that have been very effective and had a great impact on local and national economies as well.
And one of the reasons why co-ops are an important part of this discussion is that the law varies from state to state, but generally speaking, the securities burdens on somebody who wants to set up a co-op or someone who wants to borrow money from their members to, say, expand the co-op, or who wants to, like Co-op Power, take money from the members and then be creative with other business development in the neighborhood, that those securities filings are much, much lighter than creating, say, your own stock issue. And so this really is a little bit of an end run that people are using around securities laws.
You're listening to Writers' Voices. I'm Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Michael Schumann, author of Local Dollars, Local Cents. We also have Caroline Kilborn as our co-host, and Bert Chinowski, who is featured in this book, is also with us today here in the studio. And Michael, I wanted to ask you about the foreword to your book, which carries a rather well-known name. How did you get Warren Buffett's son, Peter, to write your foreword?
Well, so interestingly, so Peter Buffett and I were contemporaries as undergraduates at Stanford, but we never knew each other there. That was one of our connections. He is a musician, but like all the Buffett children, he received a modest allocation, modest compared to what Warren could give, but by any of our standards, huge, to set up his own foundation, which is called the Novo Foundation. And the Novo Foundation, over the years, has developed a portfolio around supporting women and girls around the country, actually even around the world. And of late, they've gotten interested in how you can create an economy that would be especially supportive of women entrepreneurs. And that's how they got interested in Bali and a lot of the local economy work we're doing in the United States. So it's been through several years of, you know, working with them, and they've been very generous to Bali, that I've gotten to know Peter and his spouse, Jennifer.
Well, you know, I remember Warren Buffett said that he wanted to leave his children enough to be able to do something, but not so much that they would do nothing.
Which is wise.
Great slogan.
Yeah. It really is.
Yeah. Michael, you talk a lot about the restrictions on investing in small businesses, the SEC restrictions, but, you know, most businesses don't do public offerings, don't register with the SEC. How do they get money?
Well, small businesses right now, you know, by and large, they are very limited in how they can get money through conventional financing. That is, you know, banks and credit unions and thrifts. And whatever was available in the pre-2008 days has been pretty well shattered by the financial crisis. Now, it is true that banks have opened up a little bit more to business lending. But here's an interesting statistic, which is, you know, over the last generation, banks have gotten very, very concentrated. And in fact, the biggest bank in the United States now, Bank of America, has more in capital assets than all small and medium banks put together. I mean, that's how dramatic the consolidation has been. But nevertheless, those small and medium banks are doing more than half of all the small business lending right now. So small banks, medium banks, really are just much more predisposed to using their capital to support local business than our larger banks. So that's why I think within Bali and the local economy movement, the Move Your Money campaign launched by Arianna Huffington and others, you know, was considered very important. And in fact, you know, since that campaign was launched, something like 2 million people have joined consumer credit unions. But, you know, to go back to your question, where else do small businesses get their money? Mostly their own credit cards, you know, if they still have them. They borrow from friends and families and fools, as the saying goes. And they, you know, it's very hard for them to get financing. And I think, you know, even when there is a local investment revolution, it's still going to be hard, and arguably should be hard, for startups to get financing to get going. And that, you know, we only want to support extraordinary entrepreneurs. But One of the things that I noticed in the overall capital markets out there is that you have many, many small businesses that are proven successful. They're out there 5 or 10 years, they're doing well, they want to expand, and they have nowhere to go. There are just no easy mechanisms for them to find, you know, several hundred thousand dollars, a couple of million dollars to, say, build the next restaurant, to build a small chain of grocery stores based on a successful one-off grocery store. And I think what's happened is that there have been a bunch of institutions, you know, some of which Burke has been instrumental in Iowa, doing micro-lending and intermediate capital supplies that meet some of that demand, but it needs to be increased by one or two orders of magnitude, because, we're touching just a tiny percentage of deserving businesses right now.
So, Bert, how did you and Michael get connected?
Through Bali.
Through Bali.
Yeah, we met at one of the annual Bali conferences. I think this year it's in Grand Rapids, Michigan, but I attended a Bali conference in Berkeley, one in Denver, and we were in the stage together.
So, Michael, would you, I know I had asked you to read from the book. Would you be interested in reading what you wrote about Bert's efforts here?
Sure. Okay. I'd be happy to read something from there. And it's the whole section is probably too long to read, but let's read just an excerpt of it.
All right.
And so my description of Bert's work is in a chapter called If I Were a Rich Man. And the reason for that chapter title is that a lot of the pioneering work in local investment has been done, you know, with and by that 1% who are accredited investors. And I consider the work that Bert has done some of the most innovative work with accredited investors in the country. So, all right, so the section is called The Angels of Iowa. The word entrepreneurs have for deep pocket investors who will write a check, for many thousands of dollars is angels. Like their biblical counterparts exquisitely painted on the cathedral ceilings, the angels of finance swoop down with magical powers to help earthly innovators realize their commercial dreams. Many fly solo, each with a quirky personal philosophy about the right entrepreneur, the killer app, and the smartest exit strategy. Sometimes they flock together, learning that by sharing information and resources, their dollars can reach more entrepreneurs more quickly with less risk. They might form clubs where, as the lunch or dinner wraps up, local entrepreneurs have a 15-minute opportunity to pitch their business plans. For entrepreneurs, getting an invitation to one of these angel soirees is the equivalent of an actor being called to audition for a blockbuster Hollywood feature film. One of the first and best known of these clubs is the Band of Angels in Silicon Valley. And one of the first rural entrepreneurs to score big there was Bert Chinowski, who was launching one of the first voice over internet protocol, VOIP, companies in 1999. Unlike most of the other entrepreneurs pleading for help, Chinowski was decidedly not a local. True, he had worked for California for nearly two decades as a successful investment banker, but now he was sold on living and building his next venture in Fairfield, Iowa. Fairfield has a population of 9,509 and got its name by organizing and hosting the first Iowa State Fair in 1854. The city is surrounded by farms growing soybeans, corn, cattle, and hogs, but the New York Times has described Fairfield as the town that thrives largely on its abundance of startup companies. It has created created thousands of new jobs in firms making tofu, designing software, brokering oil deals, providing telecommunication services, so much so that the locals call it Silicon Valley. And one of the keys to this success has been Bert Chynowski. Bert Chynowski first came to Fairfield in 1974 when he was part of a team that put together Maharishi International University, an institution linked with the Transcendental Meditation Movement that later became Maharishi University of Management. He was one of the school's first graduates and a poster boy for consciousness-based education. Chynowski recalls, "I decided to return to Iowa in 1996, in the early days of the Internet, when I recognized before the term was coined that the world was flat and you could do basically anything from anywhere if you had a decent communications infrastructure. So I moved back with my young family to Fairfield, mostly because the quality of life was good there and there was a thriving business community doing some very innovative things in telecommunications, software, marketing, and media." Let me just read two more paragraphs. Chynowski's pitch to the Band of Angels was simple. "Fairfield, Iowa is a digital suburb of San Jose, California, and a dollar invested in a small company in Iowa goes about 5 to 10 times farther than one invested in a California-based company. Our overhead is lower, and we also have access to highly skilled technology employees who won't jump ship every 3 months to go on a new venture." Once his business was up and running, Chynowski moved on to other opportunities. He organized a boot camp for entrepreneurs in Fairfield that drew 125 people and flew in speakers and investors from all over the country, including representatives from the Band of Angels. In the year 2000, Ed Malloy, who had been the head of Fairfield's Entrepreneurs Association, was elected mayor and asked Chynowski to step in and take over his organization. Chynowski was then appointed by the former governor, Tom Vilsack, now U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, to be on the Iowa Capital Investment Board and manage tax credits for angel and venture capital investment in the state. One milestone for the board was the creation of the Iowa Fund of Funds, which invested in venture capital firms rather than directly in individual businesses. So I'm going to stop there. It goes on for another 4 pages, but the bottom line is that Bert and the relationships that he built have mobilized astonishingly more than $300 million to support largely local businesses in Fairfield, this town of 10,000. And hats off for such an amazing accomplishment.
Michael, have you ever been to Fairfield?
I don't believe I have. I've been around. I've actually spent probably to about 10 towns in Iowa, but I have not been to Fairfield.
Well, we'll have to do something about that.
All right.
Yeah, we can. I'm sure Bert has an event coming up sometime in the next year that you would be an excellent speaker for.
Well, he's talked about beaming me in virtually, so at least my electrons will
be
there.
Well, at least that. But really, you should see what we've got going on here. It's really quite
amazing. One of the things that Bert said, and maybe he can expound on this, is that Fairfield has more restaurants per capita than San Francisco, and so that everyone is doing lunch and doing deals all the time. And that I really want to see.
Well, we've had people who moved here from the coast because they Googled vegetarian restaurants, and Fairfield pops up as having like the most vegetarian restaurants per capita.
The deal on the restaurants is that each one is a business incubator at lunchtime. It's what I call an economic gardening hotspot, because we've created a culture of not only business and social networking. And when you live in a small town, you're 5 minutes from anywhere, and you can always have a meeting. Set up a meeting on short notice, or meet, and everybody has to eat, so it's easy to get somebody's attention if you just invite them out for lunch.
Well, it's true about the short notice. I emailed Bert this morning, and here he is.
So. There you're right.
Oh, yeah, I like being able to get where I have to go in 5 minutes, believe me.
That's
so,
right.
Michael, let's we're going to revisit with Bert at the end of the hour, because I know that you have to get on to another appointment, so I wanted to take a few minutes to ask you a little bit about your writing process and like how long, for one thing, I want to say that for listeners who may not be familiar with the capital markets and what things, you know, the terminology, that I think the book is extremely clear and well-written and coherent, which is really quite a challenge for this subject matter to really address the, you know, I've read a lot of things over the years by people supposedly talking about books and capital markets who really don't know what they're talking about. And I feel like you both know what you're talking about. And on the other hand, I've read ones that know what they're talking about, but the average person isn't going to be able to understand it. And you've really managed to bridge that gap. So tell us a little bit about how you do that.
Well, I appreciate that. I sometimes think about my writing as unlearning what I learned in law school systematically over the years, and trying to be more creative. But I'll tell you what has been really important for me is the public speaking. So as I mentioned, you know, 25, 30 times a year, I am doing talks on this kind of subject matter to all kinds of audiences at all kinds of levels. And so I'm constantly trying to figure out how do you take these you know, challenging, difficult issues, and how do you communicate them in a colorful way? What are the personal stories that interest people in this? What are the analogies that drive people? And so I'm constantly testing things out while I'm speaking, and sort of based on the audience response, it gives me insight into how I then do my writing. This book was very different than previous books that I've written. Previous books, I basically would sit down at the word processor and bang out a draft of the book in 3 or 4 days, just the whole thing. And of course, it was, you know, it was still very skeletal and very rough, but I would treat it like a final exam, and then I'd come back to it and say, okay, now how do I make this more interesting, more accessible? This book, because the field of local investment basically doesn't exist, so I felt like it was inventing a field that lacked definition, and I really was unsure where the book was going to wind up when I started it. I mean, I said I'd love to do it because I really want to learn about this, but I couldn't say at the outset exactly what would be in every chapter. And so this book also was, unlike the previous books, which were mostly based on secondary source material, this book was largely driven by interviews that my colleague Kate Poole conducted, and she and I kind of would go over what the contours of the interviews would be. And then based on that material, that shaped a lot of the chapters. So I kind of took the material that was given to me by the people I thought would be interesting, and that then became the bones of the book.
And how long was this process?
I would say, it's a good question, it probably, beginning to end, was about 1 year. It was supposed to be a lot shorter. Unfortunately, shortly after I took this on, my father, who was then 88, was diagnosed with a terminal disease, and so I spent many months helping him, helping my family, and it made completion on the original schedule, which envisioned more like 6 months working on this, impossible. So it took a longer time, but I think that longer time was also helpful because it gave me a chance to step away from the material periodically and really think it through. And I'll tell you one thing that happened to me in the writing of this that I'm still sorting out in my head is that the book is mostly about ways that people are investing in other people's businesses. I ultimately came to the conclusion that for many, many people, and I would even say for the vast majority of Americans, they really should be spending most of their money on themselves, in their houses, in their energy efficiency, in better food provision, in their own education, and that the whole game of the 401k and the IRA maybe is something that the average American should stay away from. And I think that the longer writing process really gave me a chance to think a little bit outside the box around that stuff.
Well, that's a controversial statement.
Yes. Yeah. And I'll tell you, the heart of the reason why I conclude this is that historically, when you look at what the average annual rate of return has been in the stock market over 140 years, it has been about 2.6%.
I read that, and that's not what we're used to hearing, is it?
No, and the reason is that, you know, when you listen to AM radio and Rick Edelman tell you about the wonders of putting your money into the stock market for a very long period of time, they give you returns both in compounded profits and in current dollars. That is, they don't take out inflation. And those two things, in a way, trick you, because you cannot compare, say, a loan that you would give to your co-op that, say, pays you off of your principal 5% dividend each year. So that's why I think that number, 2.6%, is pretty important to focus one's attention on. And the other thing that people forget about, I mean, just comparing, for example, your home investment with your IRA investment, is that with your home investment, you can get up to $250,000 of gain, and you have no tax on it. In your IRA, you're taxed on everything at the end.
Right.
So that, in addition to the mortgage interest deduction, is what makes investing in your home a much better use of your money in terms of growing your asset base than putting money into the stock market. Now, that's not to say there are people who are brilliant investors out there and do very well in the stock market, but I'm just talking about the average American and how they should be investing their money.
Of course, part of the problem is here in small-town Iowa, real estate prices never really go up very much. They go up very, very slowly. So we never have the booms in real estate prices that you have somewhere else.
So, well, I don't know if that changes. And my things. Conclusion assumes no gain in real estate.
Ah.
So you do. So what I, the $250,000 of gain is, it's tax free. Is if you happen to get a gain, but the case for investing in your own home or investing to pay down your mortgage faster really is independent of any appreciation.
You know, I've been doing income tax returns for 30 years. I've probably had 1,000 clients over those years, maybe more. I've never seen someone make $250,000 in real estate in Iowa on a single property.
What he's saying is, yeah, it's really building the equity in your home.
Right,
and
right.
There's a strategy that you can use that doesn't cost you a dime, that you can build equity in your home faster. And it's really simple. It'll cut 10 years off your mortgage, and you don't have to pay any more a month. You know what it is? Instead of making a mortgage payment once a month,
you make it
every two weeks. And it pays down the principal faster, builds your equity in your home, and you don't have to pay a penny more. And I remember doing this at a local bank here in Fairfield. They had never done this before. I said, well, can you do it? They said, well, yeah, I think we can do it, but no one's ever done it before. Why would you do it? I said, because it'll cut 10 years off my mortgage. I can save that, take that money that I would save in interest and put it into my home equity faster. So there's a little tip for you.
Yeah, or just get a 15-year mortgage to begin with, which is what I did.
And then make the payments every 2 weeks instead of once a month, and you'll pay it down in 10 years. You can turn so, your 15 here, year. Yeah.
Here's another little trick, too, which is that I conclude the local dollars, local cents book by talking about self-directed IRAs.
I wondered about that, yeah.
You know, a concept that that's so secret and unknown that a idiot's guide to the self-directed IRA has been written, but apparently is not a bestseller. and it turns out that you can actually, you know, move your IRA into the hands of the custodian, and I know people around the country who will do it for $100 or $200 a year, and you can direct them to put the money into CDs at a local bank. You could put it into a local business if they accept money from an unaccredited investor. You could put it into your local co-op as a membership or as a loan. Now, the only restriction is that you can't put the money in your own house or your own business. But interestingly, you can put a self-directed IRA in your neighbor's house. Your neighbor can put the self-directed IRA in your house. And therein lies an interesting possibility that my colleagues and I at cutting-edge capital are trying to wrap our legal heads around, which is, can we begin to create coalitions of people who are investing in various trusts that are putting money into one another's houses and thereby enjoying simultaneously the benefits of the mortgage interest deduction through tax-deferred money?
Wow, that sounds really interesting. Well, Michael, I know that you need to get on to another interview, and so we want to give you that opportunity. Do you have any? I do want to just say one more time for listeners that even if you think this topic might be a little over your head, give this book a shot because it really explains things really well. There's a lot of stories, a lot of examples, a lot of personal. There's a lot of Michael in this book, and that's a good thing.
And I do try to wrap up by admitting that unlike Bert and unlike most of the people I profile, I am an exquisite failure when it's come to making money in markets. I've done well at writing books, and I've done well at advocacy, but I have made all of the mistakes that I write about. And I think that has given me a perspective of modesty that I think helps to inform the reader as well.
No, that's good, because you've been there. You've been there, done that, as they say, and so you know how to avoid it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being with us today, Michael. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
All right.
Good luck with Fairfield. I look forward to seeing the town one of these days.
I certainly hope so.
So the book is Local Dollars, Local Cents by Michael Schumann. I'm sure you can get it locally.
It's published by Chelsea Green Publishing, which is a great publishing company. And it is, you can order it from your local bookstore. That's the best way to get these books. Or also, of course, through the internet. So, all right. That's, I wanted to ask Bert a little bit more about what he's doing, you know, a kind of an update on what you're doing in terms of local investing.
Well, the next event that we have is the Local Economy Summit here in Fairfield. This is the fourth year that we've done it, and it's turned out to be a really great event. It takes place Saturday, March 24th at 9:30 in the morning at the Fairfield Public Library. And we will, I think, feature Michael Schumann via Skype for that event. But we really discuss local economy issues and what's going on in the local economy, the job picture, and things like this. And this is the only event of its kind here in that I know of in Iowa. The other thing that I'm working on is I'm a board member of something called Iowa Community Capital. and it is an investment equity fund that targets co-ops and food-based businesses here in Southeast Iowa. And we are going to use that as a poster boy, if you will, or poster girl, to raise equity in a regional venture capital fund. And as part of that project, I've been working on a local food or a food innovation and venture center here in Fairfield, and I'm just about completed a feasibility study because we want to really create deal flow for this venture capital fund. I also have been involved in setting up an Iowa micro loan program for the state, and that's fairly robust. Those are loans from $5,000 to $35,000. And we have, you know, a really great example of locally owned businesses here in Fairfield that were featured in last year's Fairfield Edge magazine, talking about where the jobs have come from in Fairfield. And don't get me wrong, I love it when companies sell out, they do IPO or whatever, but typically those companies and those jobs disappear in a couple of years. It frees up resources, equity, and capital into new ventures. But it's the locally owned companies like Harper Brush, Dexter Apache, Cambridge Investment Research, that have really created the steady job growth and steady jobs here, job base here in Fairfield. And so I think those are real critical things regarding this.
Harper Brush is right across the street.
That's exactly right. You can look it right over my shoulder here. Yeah. Plus their big plan here. And the Harper Brush story is a really great one.
Oh, yeah.
And I love what they've done there. One of the things that we featured in the Fairfield Edge was that they have a commitment to a zero carbon footprint as a company mandate. And I think that is an awesome thing to do. And one of their fastest growing products are their eco brand of products that are made out of recycled plastic.
Well, I'm very grateful to Harper Brush because they gave my daughter a nice scholarship through the Jefferson County Foundation for college back when she was starting college. And this is at the time when I was starting Aeron, and I had all my money wrapped up. I had nothing.
That's the other.
I was investing in a business.
That's the other advantage of a local ownership. People contribute, invest back into the community because they realize they need to do placemaking. They need to improve the amenities. Mm-hmm. Eric Schwartz, Cambridge Investment Research, has made a big contribution, as has Harper Brush and a lot of other people, to the Fairfield Arts and Convention Center.
Oh yeah,
the new MUM Sustainable Living Center and things like that. So it's there's a natural give back.
So Bert, back to your appearance in Local Dollars, Local Cents, how was it to be interviewed, and do you feel like he got it right?
They did a pretty good job. There's a few little points there that, you know, I wish I'd caught in terms of the review, but I thought they were very generous in their praise. I thought he was going to read the part about, imagine if there was 1,000 Bert Chynowskis in small communities all over the country. I really appreciate that, and I appreciate the connection with Michael. This is a hot topic. I promote a concept called economic gardening, and local economy is economic gardening 1.0.
Well, thank you for joining us, and we're out of time. And
oh my gosh,
good
we
thing
are.
We did your quote at the beginning.
No,
or
I
you
got
have
another one.
Okay,
got another
all
one.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Stephen Sondheim said this: "Opportunity is not a lengthy visitor."
See you next week on Writers' Voices.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.